For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on Unlimited Welcome for $45 per month with AutoPay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on Unlimited Welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. With me is Michael Walker. How are you doing, Walker?
That's me. I'm doing great.
I'm glad to hear that, Walker. We have a update from last week. I mused openly about the fate of Prospero Hall, a design collective that reliably produced licensed projects that were, quite frankly, delightful and often good games besides. In particular, their work on Groundhog Day, I think, is kind of genius in about how to turn an unadaptable movie into a board game. It mostly rips off the mind mechanically, but it was joyous.
I think they did really well. They did Fast and the Furious too, I believe.
They also did Fast and the Furious, which was also delightful. Anyway, a listener pointed out that a news story that I just completely missed, and so I was very remiss. So Goliath, when they acquired Funko's board game division, basically shuttered Prospero Hall. They're like, oh, we're very, very pleased to be working with a track record of very talented individuals, and you're all fired. You know, standard sort of corporate acquisition nonsense. A number of the members of Prospero Hall have founded Tempest Workshop, which has not yet released any new designs, but they're kind of an advisory slash design collective sort of thing. And so one hopes that as many of the talented people in Prospero Hall as possible landed on their feet, and I hope to see future output from them in the near future. So thank you very much for pointing that out, and rest in peace, Prospero Hall, because sometimes good things cannot survive capitalism. Then again, Prospero Hall was...
We're not allowed to have nice things, Mark.
Yeah, it's just capitalism, what capitalism giveth with one hand, capitalism taketh away with another, because Prospero Hall was a design collective that worked in a company adapting licensed products, so it's hard for me to, like, it's like, ooh, the purity of commerce and the degradation of commerce, I don't know, there's a lot going on. So, this is a board gaming podcast. We're going to talk about the games we played last week, we're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter, and then we're going to talk about our feature game, which is Beyond the Horizon. Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, we streamed this week Space Alert by Vlada Chvátal and put out by CGE Games. This is a part real-time, part program, your action type game. There's a soundtrack playing. It's going to tell you, you know, threats coming in and what turn they're coming in, so you can sort of program in, well, if it's coming in turn four, then I'm going to have to be over by the weapon in turn four, and I'm going to shoot it a couple times. So Jimmy, you got to, you know, get me more energy. So
you're
going
to trust Jimmy?
No, Jimmy doesn't know what he's doing.
That's a bad
Jimmy's
call.
Up playing with robots and flying around the ship over in the red zone where there's no threats. Anyway, check it out. It's on the stream, on our live channel on YouTube if you want to have a fun time, because we sure did.
It
was great.
How'd it go? Did you make it?
No, we did not make it. We did two missions. We used the... There is a ton of user content on there. So we used all the Star Trek soundtracks.
Oh, cool.
So we played those. There's also... They've also done all the paperwork and stuff. You can even print out. So everything is Star Trek for your...
I respect
your
that.
And Space Alert games.
This is true. This is less true with every passing year. The vibe of Space Alert and the vibe of Star Trek to me... This is just to me. I'm a Next Generation guy, right? Original series and Next Generation to me is the tone of Star Trek, which is not compatible with the tone of Space Alert. That having been said, what with Lower Decks and the new stuff, the tone of Star Trek is now all over the map. And I say this not necessarily as a pejorative. It's just the tone has shifted considerably in terms of what's available. So I guess now, it vibes a lot more with Space Alert. It's just at the time when Space Alert came out, before all that stuff, I was like, eh, I respect the fact they're both in space, but
Yeah, Star Trek back then was all very form. Everyone was very skilled at their job.
Everyone was very good at their job. Everyone, even in times of crisis, everyone kept their cool. And one word that I would not use to describe it is madcap. And Space Alert is always madcap.
It did. Like the second mission, it was like, okay, Warmbor and I, we've got this blue zone down pat. He's firing that gun. You know, he's firing a gun there. I'm going to come over and fire a gun as well. And he goes, good, you know, three turns I'm firing. Okay, it says, well, I'll come in and fire in these three turns. And I'm like, so you're firing the top gun, right? And he's like, no, I thought you were firing the top gun. Mission ends in 3, 2, 1, and
of course. Classic.
Yeah. Space Cyclone rips us apart.
That's Space Alert, one of Vladika Vettel's best. I get to play Imperium Horizons. Imperium Horizons is the third expand-alone set of the Imperium Civilization Deck Builder series by Nigel Buckle and David Tsirtse. One has to engage in all these clarifications, because if you just say Imperium, you then have to say, no, not that one, no, not that one, no, not that one. So this is Imperium Horizons. And what I really appreciate about the Imperium series, I love the Imperium deck building games. I love how evocative they are. I love that they've been giving attention to less explored civilizations in the civilization board and video game space. I love how strangely intricate it is in terms of its card play. I love how beautiful it is in terms of managing tempo and deck cycling. It's a marvelous series. I played as the Wagadoo Empire, and another, you know, a consequence of all these great things about Imperium is that I frequently then go down into little research rabbit holes about things I didn't understand fully. And of course, the empires of pre-colonialization Africa are largely unknown to a lot of people in traditional Western education. And so I got to learn about the Wagadu Empire, the ancient empire of Ghana, basically. And one thing in particular, which was a mechanical and thematic element in playing the Wagadu that was fascinating, is when you are pre-empire, when you're considered a barbarian state, which all civilizations in Imperium can go through, with a couple of very, very minor exceptions, you engage in a pact with Beta. And it is represented as some sort of snake spirit, and I didn't really understand what was going on, but it is a very, very high-cost supercharger to your economy. You get a higher action limit, you get a higher hand limit, but at the same time you're constantly losing territory, and if you can't, you get smacked upside the head real, real hard. I'm like, oh, what is this a representation of? And I went researching for it, and it was somewhat difficult to find because of a false cognate to a certain extent with Mihda, which is an Islamic notion of innovation, and which comes from, is represented in the Hadith, when it is said that every novelty is an innovation and every innovation is an error. Anyway, it's a huge area of theological controversy, and I'm certainly mispronouncing all of this, but this is entirely unconnected with the mythological snake, a serpent of Wagadu mythology that demanded human sacrifice in exchange for showering the empire with riches. Anyway, the reason why the circle gets closed is because, as playing the Wagadu Empire, you can then convert to Islam. It's an optional step after becoming an empire, and that gets rid of your pact with Beta, and then you're off to the races, and you're doing different things, and you can start building mosques. And
Beta's okay with that.
Well, we don't ask Beta's opinion.
Gotcha.
Whereas my opponent was playing as the Magyars, and the Magyars, as a necessary step of their evolution from barbarian state into what the game calls empire state, is they convert to Christianity. So for them, it is an inevitable part of the progression if you progress that far, whereas in the case of the Wagadu Empire, it's an optional step. Anyway, those subtle details, those bits of texture, I'm a huge fan of. I had a great time with Imperium Horizons. We both had very complicated tableaus. We both leaned into the new trade mini expansion, which I still think is kind of a step too far. I would have preferred if things had remained a little bit more streamlined, but in order to play as the Wagadu, you have to play with the trade element. So it's the kind of thing that halfway through the game, I'm then able to reinternalize and it works smoothly, but it's the one rough edge that I frequently forget how it works without refreshing my recollection of the rules. And it does definitely contribute to a sense of tableau bloat, which is fine. You know, it's a relatively complicated tableau builder as it is in some cases. The Wagyu really leaned into that. I had a lot of cards to juggle. And so the turns got very cumbersome. And the person I was playing with said I would never want to play with three players. And I said, well, I've played with three players before, and it kind of works, but not with these empires. I wouldn't want to play with these civilizations, that's for certain. At any rate, fabulous time. I love Imperium Horizons. I love Classics and Legends too, but Horizons has really leaned into exploring more of the strange ideas that you can explore with the game, like cultists or Martians, as well as a lot of these other empires that are underexplored. Massive fan, Imperium Horizons. Nigel Buckle, David Tsirtse, published by Osprey Games in 2024.
So after we did Space Alert, we also streamed all four of the new CMYK games. They're Magenta series, the card games. We blew through all four of them very quickly, just so we can give a sense to the new players what they were like. So Duos is designed by Johan Strodmeier-Koehig and published by CMYK, like I said. And so Duos is more like a sort of recipe fulfillment. You group into teams, and every team member has a recipe they have to fulfill, be it like two pairs or a run or two unique pairs, whatever it might be. And there's also one in the middle. And so you're drawing cards from a pool in the middle or from the top of the deck and trading cards with your teammate and trying to fulfill these recipes as quickly as possible. That's Duos. Figment is the one we've talked about, where it's the cards covered with four different colors and different degrees of percentages, and you sort of have to arrange them in the right order. Fives is this very unique trick-taking game where the back of all of the cards are pink five, and you can play it as magenta five, but only one person is allowed to do that per round. And you are trying, and when you win a trick, you take that card and it adds to a score, and you're trying to get closest to 25 or 25 right on without going over, without busting. And then there's Fruit Fight, which is very much like Flip 7. You are flipping up, you're flipping fruits, and you're either, you know, hitting or busting. If you get a fruit that you already have, then you bust. If you get fruit that other players have, then you steal those fruit. If it makes it back around to your turn and you still have fruit in front of you, then you get to score that. You go through the deck and you're done. All four of these games are very solid. Very glad. Everyone was happy that was playing. None of them are busting out as, you know, one of the greatest card games ever, but they're all very solid and work very well. Glad I got a chance to try them. These are all review copies that we got from CMYK. They're new Magenta line. I would check them out if you had a chance.
Solid, I think, is an excellent word for all of them. The only standout for that for me is Figment by Wolfgang Warsch. And that's only because it is radically unlike most other gaming experiences that I have in terms of what it's asking me to do. This is not a slight against, you know, Fruit Fight, Fives, or Duos, but Duos, as you say, is recipe fulfillment. It's a very good recipe fulfillment game, very straightforward, but recipe fulfillment is a thing we do all the time. Fruit Fight is a very good push-your-luck game, but push-your-luck is a pretty common gaming trope. Figment, on the other hand, really kind of takes a step back and is more kind of, can I do something with a card game that other card games don't do? And I very much appreciate that. I will happily play any of the Magenta line, and I'm very curious to see where it goes going forward. I mean, CMYK is such an impressive publisher in so many ways in terms of what they put out. Wilmot's Warehouse and Wavelength and the Magenta line, it's reliably excellent, and sometimes they make things that are truly genre-defying, and that is something that I'm always happy to watch as a consumer. Walker showed me Heap of Sheep. Heap of Sheep is the high-flying game of flinging sheep. Now, unusual, just as a side note, we use Board Game Geek as our database of choice, as well anyone would in the context of hobbyist board games, and frequently one encounters mass-market board games where the designer is not credited. I was expecting Heap of Sheep to have an uncredited designer.
I agree.
What I was not expecting was for the designer to be credited, but for the Euro publication to be unknown. This was truly unusual. 9 times out of 10, it's the other way around. Anyway, so this was designed by Dominic Yard and published by Fat Brain Toy Company. There's got to be a Your Mother joke in there somewhere. I don't know what it is, but it's there. And it's weird. I was vaguely impressed, but simultaneously crushingly disappointed. I was impressed at the mechanisms of things. What you're doing is you have a plastic launcher, and you're flinging Velcro sheep into a pen. And there's Velcro at the bottom of the pen, but also the sheep will stack up on top of each other. honestly, the sounds of Heap of Sheep are very satisfying. So there's a little twang when you're launching from the launcher, and the thwack when a sheep lands directly on top of other sheep and it forms this lovely sheep stack. It's great. The problems are that it's not really much of a game.
No.
As a toy, it's great. As a game, it could have been great. There are a couple things holding it back. For one, the launcher seems a little arbitrary. Not the most reliable thing in the world. As you know, we here at So Very Wrong About Games believe in trusting the launcher. You can't trust the launcher in the context of Heap of Sheep. Especially given that one of the ways you can play is a real-time version, where your job is just to get all your sheep into the pen as fast as possible. But the problem is, if you miss a shot, the sheep's going to be on the other side of the room. I don't care how your room is laid out. That's just asking for trouble. You need a big open space where everyone, and then you need full contact rules. It's a whole thing. I don't really know how to engage with that. And on top of that, there's no real incentive for varying the shots. You're going to be doing the same shot the entire game. If anything, the game gets easier because as the Tower of Sheep grows, the surface area upon which you can adhere also expands. Now, this might be compensated. I've devoted all too much thought to Heap of Sheep. But this would have been more satisfying if the original pen were less good at keeping the sheep in, right? If the pen only really worked when you landed on the Velcro, that would be one thing. But as it is, so long as you get them in the vague vicinity of the pen, you're going to be fine all the time. So it ends up feeling far too much like a one-note thing. So again, great toy, very charming, very cute. I was very pleased to fiddle around with it for 10 minutes. But there are some toys that elevate themselves, that keep the toy factor, but are also a solid dexterity game.
Agreed.
Unfortunately, Heap of Sheep doesn't qualify.
But I think it's going to be great. I bought it for my granddaughter. I think she's going to love it. I can't wait. What I am thinking, though, is when you assemble the pen, there are four fences that you put in. They are angled, and they're angled out so they can catch the sheep. I'm wondering if we can flip it around so they'll be angled in.
I could get behind that.
And therefore, there'll be less area for the sheep to hit, and it might change it slightly. I'm not saying there's no game there. It's just a fun time.
Yeah, yeah. Part of me was thinking that I'm not in the business of fixing games, but if I were in the business of fixing games, I think a scoring mechanism would do wonders. Like, so there's four different colored sets of sheep. You could make it so that every player had different scoring conditions based on different colors of sheep. You could give people, in a two-player game, you could give them two full-color sets, or you could mix them up so that everyone had all four colors. I don't know. Change things up that way. Have different scoring conditions based on where it landed in the pen, or whether it was touching a sheep, or touching the pen, or whatever. I don't know. Like, I could imagine a context in which, just spitballing, where if a sheep is overhanging any part of the table, such that it's extending over past the edge of the pen because it's just clinging to other sheep, that could be worth a bonanza of points. I don't know. There are things that could have been done, but as it is, it's just the same shot every time. So as a toy, it's okay. But as a dexterity game, I confess, I was expecting more from Heap of Sheep. Does that make me the fool? Possibly. But I will say this. If I had spent my own hard-earned money on Heap of Sheep, based on what was promising, I would not feel that I had been fleeced.
That was bad. All right. Mark and I got to play Crokino. This is designed by Canada, and the board that we the board that we played on was published by Mayday Games. It was a crowdfunding board that I got, and I feel as though Crokino boards might fall into the vacuum category of you will get what you pay for with a vacuum.
Good analogy, yeah.
But even though this board was slightly cheaper than the, you know, the deluxe tournament boards, I think it turned out very nice. It was a nice board, and I'm not going to be going into any Crokino tournaments, nor will I be hosting any Crokino tournaments.
It's true.
And so I think the board
not
I had...
Not after the incident.
It's true. I think the board that I got is perfectly fine.
You're not supposed to do that with the discs, Walker.
I'm sorry, Mark. I thought I was alone. I had a lot of fun playing Crokino. I've been playing Crokino all week. Butterfly Babe, also enjoying Crokino. Lots of Crokino being played over the last couple weeks.
I was vaguely impressed with the quality of the board. You know, this was the $100 US board, correct?
Yes.
Yeah. You can do a lot worse in terms of Crokinole because, you know, your professional level boards are many, many hundreds of dollars. The high quality hobbyist ones, I think, hover around $200 to $300. So for $100, I thought this was great. Now, you did some sanding of your own, is my impression.
Waxing.
Waxing, my apologies. Yes. A little bit of waxing is probably for the good. But yeah, it had a lovely visual and tactile quality, both the pieces and the board itself. I don't really like Crokinole very much, Walker.
Oh, yeah?
I'm sorry. Look, here's the thing with... Crokinole, in my experience, I've never played it multiplayer. I've never played it with four players. Things might change in that context. My experience with Crokinole is that it frequently just devolves into a situation where one player has a disc that's on the other side of the bumpers, and it's just too hard for the other player to get anywhere by virtue of that. It doesn't strike me as a very dynamic situation. Like, sometimes there are board states that are genuinely fun, where it's like, okay, I have to hit that, and then I think I can rebound and then gut off into the center or something like that. But I find those board states to be too few and far between. Maybe that's just because I'm a monkey, or maybe because I'm playing with people who are roughly at the level of a monkey.
I do have the note here. It says, get good.
Oh, okay. Well, that's probably my problem.
Yeah.
But in my limited experiences with Crokinole, I have not found it to be particularly enjoyable. I would play it over Heap of Sheep, sure. It definitely has a certain kind of toy factor to it. And I think that the board states and the types of shots that it's asking to do are more dynamic and evolving than Heap of Sheep. But I just don't like how the game state progresses and evolves. There's not much there. I don't think there's much there.
All right, let's talk about discs when there are things there and game and how a game can evolve differently.
Yes, please move on. I've already destroyed my credit.
We also got to play Kabuto Sumo, Sakura Slam to be precise. This is the square ring where it has these ring posts that are glued down to the four corners, which is
turnbuckles,
sort of,
please.
Turnbuckles, which is sort of another anchor that the discs will bump into and that you can use. And sort of the delivery system of the disc is slightly different as well. You sort of hook it onto a corner and that's all you can push from. So pushing from the, you know, direct center is usually not possible.
It was strange, yeah. What were your thoughts on Sakura Slam?
I loved it. Anything Kabuto Sumo is, I enjoy. It's this, you sort of lay out all these discs on this sort of mini ring, and some are stacked and they're all different sizes. And then on your turn, you're going to take some discs and you're going to slide it straight onto the board. And it's going to do this weird pushing thing where all these discs will push. Any discs that fall off, you get to put into your pool. And there are wrestling bugs in the center. And depending on how many players there are, everyone will have a bug in the middle, and you're trying to push that bug either off the ring or make it so when someone takes a turn, they have no discs to push.
I really think that Kabuto Sumo is a great game, and I think it's a great product line. I hate to talk in these terms, but these are, of course, commercial products. I loved the central idea. The central conceit was already glorious. You have these custom pieces and these weird bugs that are evocative, mostly of professional wrestlers, but not exclusively. And you have these weird special effects and these, you know, different ways to get and use custom pieces and all that. And I do think that Allplay, the publisher, has done a good job of having the expansions address stated concerns while simultaneously leaning into the theme, leaning into the ridiculousness, and introducing new game states. So this is exemplified as well by the second game that we played, which involved the Total Mayhem expansion, where chairs are introduced. And chairs work a particular way. Effectively, what happened thematically over the course of the game is Walker hit my bug in the back of the head with a chair, and consequently I was a little dazed, and Walker had a tempo advantage as a consequence. I attempted to reciprocate, but I missed. There's nothing more humiliating in professional wrestling than going and getting your own chair, coming back to the ring, and then missing with your chair. It's deeply, deeply distressing. And I'm glad that my wrestler bug was already red, so you could not see how badly he was blushing. But at the same time, my wrestler's special power, I played a promo named Dr. Bibble, and his unique piece is a very heavy piece of metal. And what you do with him is you can stack the metal on top of a piece, serving as an imperfect anchor so as to subtly guide how the pieces are going to dislodge. I was skeptical as to whether or not this would have any consequence. It does. It's not a total anchor, but it's a relative anchor. And I was actually able to see the effect it would have on my placement, my shoving. The way they've evolved the rule set, the way they've evolved the powers, so you're good with a base game. It's a small box game. It's very, very easy to approach on the entry level. But if you want to go all the way in and get the big box and the plushie and the ridiculous powers and the chairs and the coffin match and the ladder match and all that, you can.
Hey, we don't know anyone that's done that, though.
That, I think, would be an irresponsible use of money as an adult.
Yes.
Like, that would just be as silly as getting something called, I don't know, Heap of Sheep. Like,
yeah.
That would just be ridiculous and undignified. I'm just thinking hypothetically, if somebody did have the big box with all of the additional rings and all of the additional special stuff, that hypothetically would be a fun thing to play with, but Moving on. So that was Kabuto Sumo Sakura Slam. I'm a big fan of the series. I have yet to see it take a misstep. And indeed, the common criticism that I've heard of the original base game, namely that it could lead to stalemate, is something that I've seen occur once. And even then, it has been addressed considerably by some of the new rule sets. There's this now standard is the idea that the centerpiece, and you could easily mock this up with your own version if you don't have any of the new Kabuto Sumo products. There's a championship belt, which is just a piece of cardboard that you put a very small one on the center disc at setup, and an extra victory condition is shoving that off the edge of the board. So the game ends if somebody runs out of pieces, or if the belt gets shoved off, or if anybody's piece gets shoved off. And I, as I say, I never really experienced deadlocks before stalemates, but I would be very surprised if the game could stalemate under those conditions at all, realistically. But who knows? That is Kabuto Sumo, specifically Sakura Slam, which was distributed late last year after successful crowdfunding, designed by John Brieger, Michael Dunsmore, and Tony Miller.
We got to play Disney Lorcana. So this is a new Ravensburger tradable card game that has original Disney art, which is nice because there is a ton of art already out there for Disney, but this is all original on the cards. It's Expanse, you know, all of their movies, all of the shorts, you know, you name it.
All they have to do is go down in the basement where they keep their artists and illustrators, crack the whip a couple times, and then a massive quantity of art gets disgorged.
This is designed by David Lezzi, Ryan Miller, and Steve Warner, and is very sort of a Magic derivative. It's very much like Magic, and I think it is a, you know, sort of a great intro for, you know, you have for children, you have, you know, the Disney tie-in. I love how they did sort of like combos with known characters. Like Mark had Huey, Dewey, and Louie out.
Very show
Which is very, you know,
I felt pandered sweat. To and I
yeah,
loved
it. It was great. And so having all three of those at once gave him this great advantage. I was looking through cards later on. If Ursula's two eels are played together, you know, they have a synergy together. What they do differently, instead of having different colored lands, you just have this inkwell, and so you can take one of your cards. So it's a little bit of a undaunted, you know, I'm going to use this card for ink. I want to keep it in my hand so I can play it later. You throw it into your inkwell, and it'll become mana that you can use later.
What I found somewhat curious is that some cards could not be used in that way. And I was wondering what the overall deck design decision was driving that.
I'm not sure. We were playing with the Into the Inkland set, which almost all of them could be put into the inkwell. When I rifled through them, there was a few. I think it might have something to do with the powerfulness of the card or something. I'm not sure, you know,
yeah,
what.
I couldn't discern any pattern with respect to how expensive they were to play, because that is indeed where the iconography about whether or not they can be used as mana is. It's next to their cost. I assume it has something to do with deck construction. As I say, we didn't engage in deck construction. We just used some pre-constructed decks. Most of the time when I've seen that mechanism introduced, the idea that, you know, you play a card face down for some kind of resource generation, it tends to be whatever card you want. But I was just strangely curious as to what the logic was there. I'm sure someone deep into the Lorcana sphere is going to be able to illuminate me.
Deck construction is pretty easy. There's six different colors. You're allowed to include cards from two colors into your deck, and it has to be at least 60 cards. So it's nice and simple to make a deck. And it does give you that Magic feel. I'm not sure how much people actually, they're called trading card games, Mark, but I'm not sure anymore if people actually trade. I remember when Magic first started, you know, back when we were playing Stick, Stick, Rock.
Yes.
And we did Magic. That's all there was. There was no stores that sold singles. That sort of thought was ludicrous.
Yep.
And so there was actual trading going on. I'm just, younger children in grade school, they're probably trading Pokemon cards still, maybe.
Yes.
I don't know.
Pokemon cards are still a thing. I don't know how widespread.
Well, I know they're still
a
thing,
but are they still
trading? And that's what I'm wondering. I'm not sure. Probably.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I assume by now every child who's involved in this has some kind of strange economy deeply internalized. It could be the Fortnite economy. It could be online gambling economy if they're a little precocious and perhaps in trouble. It could be the Lorcana economy. It could be the Pokemon trading card economy. I don't know. When I was in elementary school, I attempted to establish a standardized value for various kinds of micro machines, but this was entirely independent of any kind of broader rarity or plentifulness. This was just based on the local economy of my elementary school.
Well, speaking of the weird economy, there is a story here. After you and I played, the set we got, like, this is, we're talking about this now because they were hard to get at first, and the big store finally got them in so we could get some. And so it came with two starters and a bunch of boosters. So after Mark and I played, I decided to go upstairs and bring back the nostalgia of, you know, opening up boosters. So I looked up online and said, you know, what are the best cards from this set? And sure enough, I managed to hit one of these, you know, top 10 or if not the best card in the set. So I brought it to the local card place. And they said, sure enough, we'll give you $75 for that card. And so I said to her, how about 50? And so she looked at me like I was completely insane.
Yeah.
And I just said to her, I said, I don't want to be part of this inflated. And all the power to all the people who do this.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not
you
saying.
You just wanted your money back.
I just wanted the money back. Yeah. Exactly. I did not want to participate. And that's just me. You know, there's people who enjoy that kind of thing.
Did
I'm just
not
one of them.
Take the extra $25, throw it into her face and say, I don't want any of your blood money.
No.
You vulture.
I did not.
Oh, okay. Well, that's basically what you were saying, though.
Could be true, but okay. We have this problem at work when these Pokemon sets come out. They're lined up at the door. We have to limit them to two a set. We mm-hmm. have them, you know, projective. I just didn't want to be part of
it. Was a vibe that
thing.
You didn't want a part of.
Exactly.
And the $25 would have made you feel like you were part of that vibe.
Exactly.
So it was cognitive dissonance, right? Yeah, yeah, that's legit.
And so that's Season of Arcana. I think it's a solid little card game.
It's fine. I mean, it doesn't really do anything very interesting. It does guarantee a high tempo, though, because there's not really any way to block. That's not really a thing. So you're effectively racing to score points, which is kind of sort of like attacking, but not really. It's a separate stat entirely. It doesn't really do damage. There's no blocking. It's like, I have this character. They generate 3 points for me. It's like, can I stop it? No.
Well, you can attack it.
No. Not you can't prevent it from doing anything. You can only attack it afterwards. You
true.
Can punish it after the fact. But
yes.
That's just it. That was a conscious tempo
yes.
decision. And I think it's largely for the good. I mean, you don't want to end up in these grinding situations where you're waiting to top deck somebody. I mean, I never really found that particularly satisfying in the context of games like this. There are ways to keep the pace up. Like, for example, Epic, which is still a game I defend. Epic, I think, is one of the best ways to ape Magic the Gathering without deck construction, as far as, or even with deck construction, but I've never tried the deck construction version. Did it with lots of cards that just had wild effects, like everything's dead. Lots of cards where it's like, everything's dead now. Okay, fine. So you don't end up in these situations where I've got 10 creatures and you've got 10 creatures, and it's like, oh, well, if I did, Which, look, there's a lot of gameplay space to be explored in there. It's just not really the kind of vibe that I want. So I was in the situation a couple turns from the end of Lorcana. This isn't a complaint. This is just an observation about how the tempo works. You know, I look at the characters you've got out. I look at the characters I've got out. It's like, oh, this is a race and you're going to win. Okay, fine. Like, and that's very much the vibe that Lorcana has. I will point out, though, Walker, that you, in an act of massive hypocrisy, introduced a house rule for Disney Lorcana. You included it in the rules explanation, and you violated it.
It's true. There's this mechanism in Lorcana where there are songs that you can play as cards, and either you can just pay the normal ink cost or the mana cost and put them out, or you can tap certain characters. It'll tell you on the song card if you have a character that's a certain powerful, you can tap that character, and they technically sing it. So I thought a great house rule would be if you play one of those cards, you must also sing the song. Just unfortunately, the card that I got, because there are actual songs from all the Disney movies, I just couldn't remember the actual song that I was going to play.
Yeah.
I remembered it after the fact, but unfortunately, yes, you're correct. I broke the rule.
As somebody who famously, in So Very Wrong About Games lore, or at least the version of it that exists exclusively in my head, was in musicals, I was waiting to hear you perform a rendition. My understanding is that your version of Ling Ling drove people to tears. It was so beautiful.
It cleared the room.
Gilbert and Sullivan themselves rose from the dead to give you a standing ovation. Anyway. Finally, we played Keyflower the Farmers. The Farmers was the first expansion to Keyflower. This is by Sebastian Bleasdale and Richard Breeze. Keyflower is by far our favorite key game. We've tried a number of others over the years, but Keyflower is definitely the best. It's got a fascinating simultaneous action and auction system where these various village tiles are available, and you can use them and you can activate them with your own workers, but at the same time, people are bidding for that tile, and whoever wins the tile is then going to pocket the workers. So you end up in these situations where you want to try to activate a tile that you're already winning, but sometimes you look over and you see somebody else's tile, it's just so good. You have to give them the workers. It's a cost you have to pay. And at the same time, there are these tempo pressures because the moment a color of worker shows up at a tile, whether it's to bid or activated, that is the color of workers that that tile is going to use for that round. So you may have a big set of yellow workers, and you really want to make a move on some tile, but if somebody activates it or bids on it with blue, well, it's only blue this round. Good luck. So that really informs the placement priority of what to do with your workers. I very much enjoy that element of management as well. And it's a great way to shake up the fundamental formula of basically worker placement-ish. And I've always appreciated that element. I don't have a lot of experience with the expansions. There have been two expansions, the Farmers and the Merchants. They are of mixed popularity amongst the Keyflower set. We played the Farmers this time, and we played the setup where all the farm tiles are included, and then some smaller number of base game tiles are included. The other way to play is just to mix everything together and have a random setup. But we had an animal-focused setup this time.
I thought it was funny when you said there was two expansions. There's 17 expansions for Keyflower.
Well, there are promos. I don't consider those full expansions. There's any number of additional boats or additional tiles or things of that nature. I don't have any of those.
Yes, that's the one thing I love about Keyflower that I leaned into this time is the fact that you're bidding on tiles that are in the middle of the table, but you can also activate those tiles. So what I was doing is I would put a pretty strong bid on them, and then near the end of the round when I thought I was going to win them, I would make sure I have meeples of that color left and activate them, because those meeples that come off that tile go back into my pool anyway. So getting that extra activation as they're coming into your village, I thought was very interesting and fun to do.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of surprisingly interesting tensions running through, but it nonetheless manages to move at a reasonably brisk pace. We played with five. With five, you're going to end up like a full 90 minutes, which at the time was considered long for a Euro. Not so much anymore. And I don't mind it, because there's a certain dynamism about I'm activating this, and then I'm going there, and then I'm visiting somebody else's village, and then I'm making a play for this tile, and then I'm thinking. So your attention is constantly being pulled in a pleasant way in all these different directions, and so I find that it moves at a pretty good clip if people are paying attention to the game state. And so I don't mind the longer sets. I think once I played Keyflower with six is starting to push it. At that point, people should know what they're doing. But the fact that it's so flexible for player count is good as well.
Definitely didn't feel like 90 minutes. Man, it was like almost over. You know what I mean? It always feels like you want that one extra turn, that's for sure.
It is one of those hobby games where you say, okay, we're going to play four rounds. And at the end of the first round, you look over and say, how am I going to get anything done? What, I'm a quarter done? That's ridiculous. But sure enough, it's not even just through escalation. It's just through greater efficiency and evolution of the economy. Because the primary way you're going to get points in Keyflower is by upgrading tiles. And to upgrade tiles, broadly speaking, you need to get the resource. And then very often, you need to drag the resource to where it needs to go. And transportation capability is so very cripplingly limited in most instances. The farmers increases the burden of your transportation requirements because you need to get the animals where they need to go, but it also introduces a new resource, wheat, which allows you to get the animals to move faster. Because apparently you feed animals. You are a farmer, Walker.
Oh, yeah.
You know this. You feed. It's basically like methamphetamine
yes.
for cows.
Well, you
right?
paint it red. You paint their wheat
yeah.
red.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then you feed it to the animals, makes them go faster.
Then they get super excited. They write a bunch of screenplays, and then they run all over the place.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I'm glad I understand. This is animal husbandry here in both Keyflower and So Very Wrong About Games. I thoroughly enjoy Keyflower. I like introducing expansion content every once in a while, but I think the base game stands on its own terms. I don't know that... It's one of those Euro games where nobody really mixes everything together and plays that way, because you end up in the situation where, in a given season, you might have one tile from the farmers, and that may be it. And so there's all these rule subsystems. It's not a huge amount, but it's a fair number, exclusively for that one tile. Or the merchant tiles might dominate the display, but then all the things that feed the merchant tiles aren't there because they're occupied by other... It's strange. So I know almost nobody who's a big fan of Keyflower that just mixes everything together. I think most people play the way we do, which is to say, you pick an expansion and play with that one, or you play the base game. So that's Keyflower the Farmers. It's got that lovely art from the sister of Sebastian Bleasdale, and... Of all the key games, it is by far my favorite, and it is a very, very good twist on worker placement and auctions from about 10 years ago. I highly recommend it if you haven't given it a try.
Those are the games we played this week. Now a quick break while we pay some bills.
For a limited time at Verizon, you can get our best price ever for a single line. Just $45 per month when you bring your phone, which is less than you spend on too tired to cook takeout every week. Get one line on unlimited welcome for $45 per month with autopay plus taxes and fees. Visit your local Columbus Verizon store by April 2nd to save. $20 monthly promo credits applied over 36 months with a new line on unlimited welcome. In times of congestion, unlimited 5G and 4G LTE may be temporarily slower than other traffic. Domestic data roaming at 2G speeds. Additional terms apply.
And we're back with the news and why it doesn't matter. Mark, we enjoy Agricola.
We do.
And often while we're playing Agricola, we say things like, boy, I wish this game had zombies in it.
You read my mind, yeah.
So, they must have heard us.
Okay.
Because now we are going to get Agricola Dead Harvest, which is Agricola with zombies.
Not a bad title.
It's going to be one of the... It's by the same Waken Realms, the same company that did the Castles of Burgundy.
Really?
Yeah, it looks as though, you know, they're going to grab these, you know, these core games that we love and mutate them into this.
I can't believe Waken Realms is doing a version of Agricola. We are living in the weirdest timeline. Roger McGowan is a titan in the wargaming industry. He was a designer and an artist for GMT Games for a very long time. If you've played a GMT game, chances are excellent you've seen his work. If you've seen the cover of any GMT game, odds are excellent that you've seen some of his work. And sadly, he passed away this week at the age of 77. And his career has truly spanned it all. He did the cover for the original Civilization of Avalon Hill. He also did the cover for Twilight Struggle. Those are two very different games, very different aesthetics for the components. And it really shows his range. He's done some of my favorite covers. Sekigahara and Churchill have excellent, excellent covers, and that's his work. He also did the cover for one of my all-time favorite games, Triumph and Tragedy. And he definitely had his own unique idiom. I very much appreciated his work, and I liked how characteristic it was and how often he experimented with different styles. His work is going to be remembered for a very, very long time after his death, and he will be missed. Rest in peace, Roger McGowan. Also in Wargaming News, Chris Farrell is one of my favorite board game critics, and he talks a lot about historical war games as well as Euros, and he has a Substack now. So for the first time in my life, I have now subscribed to a Substack for Chris Farrell. It's called Illuminating Games. He has, on the 24th of February, published a most excellent essay on Upfront. And one of the observations he makes is that how Upfront grapples seriously with the fact that a large number of soldiers in World War II did not ever fire their weapons. And it just grapples with the humanity of being a soldier. And even though a typical engagement in Upfront is going to have much, much higher casualties than an actual engagement in World War II. Anyway, there are a lot of ruminations on warfare and game design about World War II in this article. There's a link in the episode notes, but generally speaking, I highly recommend all of Chris Farrell's observations. Chris Farrell has a Substack.
Since this is an episode divisible for five, we've allowed ourselves to do some self-promotion on these particular episodes. Guess what? We have a Patreon. So you can go to the Patreon. That will give you access to our Discord, which is, we have what we call the Pledge of Indifference, which is a whole show just based on upcoming crowdfunding things. You'll have access to unedited episodes that will be ad-free. Mark does great episodes like Bloat and SWAT Guy Lab. He also does Sizzler, which is a show just about Spirit Island, which is fantastic. So lots of stuff. Not only will you get access to upcoming new stuff, you'll have access to the backlog of all of these things that we've already done. Go check it out. We are on Patreon.
Additionally, I should note that SwagCon is coming up. That is not going to be the final title. Working title is Congrès, So Very Wrong About Games. Fun Times, Good Vibes Only, Trend Rights or Human Rights Board Game Jamboree. We're working it out. We're going to get a tighter version of that, I think. Or maybe even a longer version. I don't know. Give me enough time to cook, and it might end up the size of a novella. At any rate, registration is going to be opening soon, and early registration is going to start with patrons. So the first people to register are going to be those that are subscribed to our Patreon. So if you're inclined to get in on that action, there's still time, but I'm going to be opening it up in the coming days. There will be, of course, open registration for people who are not our patrons. Obviously, we're just sussing out the financials of that because it's a little bit more complicated because we've never been in a position of taking money from people when it was not associated with Patreon before. Well, other than our merch, but that's handled by a separate service. I don't think the people who print out our t-shirts are particularly keen to help us run a convention in Kingston, Ontario. Anyway, that's going to be July 25th, 26th, and 27th in the aforementioned Kingston, Ontario. We're looking forward to it. We're looking forward to meeting some listeners and playing some games with listeners.
Lots of games.
And then leaving with fewer games than how many games we came in with.
That's right.
People are going to get some free stuff.
Free games for everyone.
Everybody.
Mandatory!
So that is the news and why it doesn't matter. Let us now move into our feature game, which is Beyond the Horizon. Beyond the Horizon was designed by Adam Hill, Ben Pinchback, and Matt Riddle. Pinchback and Riddle co-designed Fleet, and all three of them co-designed River Valley Glassworks. Adam Hill also co-designed Godspeed. And this is in conjunction with Dennis K. Chan, who designed Beyond the Sun, which is the forebear of Beyond the Horizon. Beyond the Horizon is sort of the classic Civilization re-theming of Beyond the Sun, which was a sci-fi themed game. So, Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Beyond the Horizon?
Well, when one plays Beyond the Horizon, you're really just trying to figure out which end of your population pawn is up. You're also trying to remember what level your settler and or soldier was, because you've just knocked off all the tokens off of them for the fifth time. And when you're not doing that, you're wondering why you just paid $65 when you could have just been playing Beyond the Sun. We're going to be comparing this to Beyond the Sun a lot. But
it's inevitable. You cannot escape the comparison.
It is way different, because the basic actions and the advanced actions are on the bottom, not the side. Totally different game.
No, it is. Look, it ends up feeling very different, despite the fact that superficially the mechanical differences might seem negligible. Let's start with complaining about the components, and then we can move on.
Well, I just wanted. That's one more thing: is the fact that
he's not done being unhelpful. He's got to be more unhelpful.
No, it is helpful. There was an
You know, some podcasts riff off of each other and let topics evolve. You, on the other hand, is like, well, I had these five cracks to make. I've made four of them, and then I paused. Mark tries to say something. No, we got to go back to the way. Go ahead, Walker.
No, I just want to make sure.
I never want to interrupt the flow of your ideas.
There's no flow. There's just, I just want to make sure people understand that there was an expansion for Beyond the Sun, and it seems as though they've incorporated a lot of those ideas right into the base game. So you are actually getting a game with the expansion.
I wouldn't necessarily put it in those terms, but yes, some of the ideas.
Concepts of what the expansion were about, yeah.
So let's just start with the component quibbles so we can move on to the gameplay analysis. In Beyond the Sun, you had these very charming dice that were not rolled that could be either just generic resources when they were on your board, represented by a box, or they could be a person, in which case it was represented by a person, or they could be a spaceship, which was the other four sides of the dice, representing how strong it was on a strength from 1 to 4. These have been replaced in Beyond the Horizon with these, they're goblets. They look like wooden goblets, frankly, where if they're upside down goblets, they're supposed to be on your board. If they're right side up, they're available to play. And then if they're, instead of being ships from strength 1 to 4, they can either be settlers of strength 1 to 6 or soldiers of strength 1 to 6. And to do this, what you do is you put a little token on top. This change results in two differences. Number one, in my experience, people have a great deal more difficulty parsing the iconography about where the worker comes from. I tell them, if it's dark and face down, it comes from your board. If it's light, then it's available. People seem to have a harder time remembering that. In Beyond the Sun, it was just a box is just a thing on your board. That's all that it is. So if it says box to ship or person to ship, you know the difference. The other thing is that those little tokens that you put on top of your little worker people, if they become settlers or soldiers, they fall over all the time.
And they're different on either side. So when they fall off, it's like, well, what side was it on? It's like, well,
I've had less of a problem with that, but it is a potential issue. So anyway, moving on, these complaints have been raised a fair number of times. I think that's because they are very widespread. How consequential that is to your playing, your mileage may vary, but these are absolutely issues that ought to be addressed, especially, again, when in Beyond the Sun, the components were perfectly functional, and now they're a little bit less so. So, Walker.
Yes, Mark. Speaking of issues, let's talk about government cards.
Let's.
So, at the beginning of the game, there are a set of government cards, and they are also two-sided, so you sort of shuffle them up and flip them around and put them out, and then you pick these government cards, which are all perfectly balanced.
Oh, yes, they're all completely perfectly balanced. There is definitely no consensus that one of them is kind of garbage and another one of them is kind of overpowered. In point of fact, again, talking a little bit about the discussion of Beyond the Horizon, Simone Luciani himself, who was involved in the development of Beyond the Horizon because he works with Cranio for a lot of their work. Showed up and said, oh, it's funny that you don't like this one. We found it very, very powerful. And it's like, look, maybe when you've played the game 50 times, the balance shakes out slightly better. But on the face of it, based on our experiences, they have been A, consistent, and B, striking about some of them being better than others. So again, your mileage may vary on that one too. I've kind of gone on an arc with Beyond the Horizon. And indeed, that is the last part of the arc, which is, yeah, these governments seem pretty unbalanced. I wish you could just yank them out. The problem is they're kind of deeply integrated with a lot of the other elements of the game with respect to how the tracks work and various upgrades. When I started, after my first play of Beyond the Horizon, I hated it, primarily in comparison to Beyond the Sun. I'm like, this is a step back in every way. And then I started playing it a couple times more. I'm like, okay, I can see why for somebody with different preferences this might be preferable. I can kind of see that it is doing something a little bit different. It is bringing Beyond the Sun, which was a comparatively streamlined, comparatively focused experience, into a slightly more combo-tastic modern Euro contemporary vibe, right? And now, at the end of my arc, I'm like, yeah, but the people who want that combo-tastic Euro-y vibe probably are less willing to put up with unbalanced basic government cards than I am. And so now I'm kind of wondering who the audience might be. I always knew that Beyond the Horizon wasn't for me. It really isn't. My TLDR of the review is get Beyond the Sun and be happy. But I'm increasingly struggling to see how the kind of combo-tastic Euro players that might like this, these changes might appreciate some of the overall rough around the edges balancing work.
Yeah, people might have thought, because in Beyond the Sun, there is a sideboard, which is an area majority sort of space combat area where you're going to be able to manipulate your board a little bit. And some people might have thought that it's just too arbitrary and not utilized enough. And so they've changed that completely to this whole sort of using your settlers to explore around and using soldiers to fortify areas. And even the main board, there are restrictions that will stop you from advancing on the tech tree and force you to interact with that board. You do not have an option. You now must interact with that board, or otherwise you have to luck out and get techs that will let you research level 3 and level 4, because if you don't find those techs, then you are now engaging with that board.
The fact that it's forced doesn't bother me a whole lot. I mean, the more charitable way to put that is it's more now tightly integrated with what's going on in the main tech board. And indeed, the colonization angle of Beyond the Sun, it's one of those things that you have to stress to new players. It can be worth a lot of points. Don't sleep on it. Because, as you say, it's off over there. It's still off over there in Beyond the Horizon. But, as you say, it's more tightly tied to technological progression. My beef primarily with the side hex board as it evolves is that it is very cumbersome in terms of rules grit, and also very cumbersome in terms of fundamental turn structure. Because not only do you now have twice as many different kinds of units that do different things in different ways, although sometimes they do things in the same way if you have the right government card, whatever, is that there's now three different ways you can put out your influence. Maybe four, if you want to stress the distinction. And on top of that, there's a new subphase that only works when you have certain kinds of tiles access to you, except for one exception where you don't need a tile, it's fine. You just need the settler. Only a settler, though, not a soldier. And sometimes you do those actions during your main phase, but sometimes you get tokens that let you do the actions during the second phase. It took what was a very straightforward turn structure and made it shockingly more cumbersome. And that's before you start factoring into the fact that a lot of these new one-off effects are vastly more combo-tastic than they used to be. And so turns in Beyond the Horizon do that thing that a lot of contemporary Euros do. Your turn might be 3 seconds, or it might feel like 3 hours.
Well, that's the problem, because newer Euros have learned the lesson. They give you your income at the beginning of your turn, and some other fiddly things that you do are at the beginning. Then you do your action, your turn's done, and the next person can go. This is falling into this, like what we talked about with Mistborn, where you do your turn and then at the end of your turn you get this thing and the other things happen, you forget about them. This is what happens in this game, is that these combos start going off and your turn seems long, and then while after that, then you do your income, then you do these other, so it just seems that your turn takes that much longer. It should be your, it should be fiddly stuff first, action and done, That way the next person can start. They're not waiting. It's like, oh, I forgot to do my income. Oh, wait, can I go back? Because I could play this land territory and I have this token I can use. And all of these little fiddly things at the end of your turn, which should be at the beginning of your turn.
Huh. I don't know that I agree. I don't know that I disagree strongly. I just don't think that the timing of the income would make a huge degree of difference. I think the biggest problem is that in Beyond the Horizon, there are a lot of effects that say, okay, I do this action. This action gives me the tile. Oh, this tile says I get to research a level 2 tech for free. I hate those. They seem vastly better. Like you might get a random effect, a random card or random tile that says, take 2 money or research a tech for free. It's like that. Those two are very different. Anyway, so, but moving that aside, and researching that tech gives you a one-off bonus, which nests another thing, which
I was going to say that doubles down because not only does it say research a tech, but it says research a tech with no prereqs.
Yeah.
And normally when you research a tech, it costs usually a load of money. Plus you have to have the prereqs. These cards bypass both of those.
Yeah. Generally speaking, this is kind of the overall thrust of my critique about Beyond the Horizon. Beyond the Sun was a game about a tech tree. There was a tech tree.
Yeah.
And yeah, there was the colonization board, and it can be worth a lot of points. But thematically and spatially and visually, it was primarily about a tech tree. And the emphasis was cemented in terms of the victory conditions, in terms of your overall priorities, in terms of the overall arc of an individual session. And Beyond the Horizon has kept that tech tree, but there's a whole bunch of things that kind of undermine the fundamental way that the tech tree works. One of them is the additional amount of attention you need to pay to other stuff, both in terms of rules, grit, and components, and just sheer table space and cognitive load. But on top of that, there seems to be an additional emphasis on random one-offs that let you bypass the normal restrictions of the tech tree, which is really cool because the tech tree is fun, but at the same time, I find unsatisfying from a strategy game perspective.
Agreed. And so they have the goal cards, much like Mark just talked about, just like Beyond the Sun, where there's going to be 3 goal cards, overall objectives that everyone's going for, that which will also dictate the end of the game.
Well, now there are 3 objectives, and they each come from their own deck, as opposed to the objective structure in Beyond the Sun, which always had 2 of the same objectives, one of them being research a level 4 tech. Again, that emphasis on the tech tree. That objective exists in Beyond the Horizon, but it is in a random deck of 4 cards. And then there was the other objective, which was colonize 4 planets, which was always in play, which if you were focused on colonization, typically, it was very difficult to get both of those 2, right? Colonizing 4 systems and getting a level 4 tech would be like crowning achievements and worth a whack of points. Now, if you were really doing well, you might get both of those. But those kind of represent the 2 poles of how to prosper in Beyond the Sun. And then you would get other objectives that were somewhat independent of those. In Beyond the Horizon, you get 3. So in theory, there's a greater variety, but again, greater variety, I don't think, does this system justice. You want lots of variety in terms of the techs. Absolutely. But Beyond the Sun already had lots of different texts that were kind of fun and sci-fi and named interesting things. If anything, the additional variety in Beyond the Horizon, I think, undermines the central appeal of the design.
Also, I'm not saying that there was a ton of blocking in Beyond the Sun, but at least it felt like occasionally there were spots you couldn't go to because people had gummed them up. This never, I shouldn't say never, hardly ever happens in Beyond the Horizon.
In Beyond the Sun, in order to colonize the system, you needed to show up with more military strength there than anybody else. In the context of Beyond the Horizon, you just need to meet a threshold. There's nothing I can do to prevent you from fortifying or settling something. And indeed, in some narrow context, it's actually in my interest that we both be on the same tile. But setting all that aside, that I wish they'd kind of leaned into that more. But consequently, it feels like the sideboard, as it grows in rules load and attention, it lowers in player interaction because the map keeps getting bigger and bigger and I can just settle the things that I discover and fortify those things that I've settled and call it a day. And I don't really need to worry about what you're doing on your side of the map.
I meant more like the worker placements on the board.
I know. I was riffing on that. I was taking an idea and I was developing it. See, Walker, sometimes...
I got you now. I just wanted to make sure...
Podcast hosts...
I was clear team,
they riff
on
ideas.
What I was talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Honestly, I, in terms of actual worker blocking, I think they're comparably rare because, again, you know, you're developing different techs. I have access to this tech that you don't, and so I get to do the thing, and therefore I'm not really running into you. I will say, though, with respect to the techs, I think that the Civ theming doesn't do the techs any justice. When you have researched engineering before you've researched the wheel, and then later on you go and research the wheel, my eyebrows get raised. When it's just a series of different, like, sci-fi technobabble, it gets to be sufficiently cool and kind of vaguely plausible. It's like, oh, you developed cold fusion before you developed android civil rights. Okay, sure. Like,
and I remember the text being a little more interesting in Beyond the Sun. Like, when you flip them up and it's like, oh, that, you know, that worked, you know, but nothing I think overly interesting came up.
I think that's mostly by virtue of the thematic trappings. I mean, it's fundamentally playing around in the same broad wheelhouse of effects. It's just that with Beyond the Horizon, sometimes things take a couple extra steps or interact with a couple new resources or new elements of the turn structure.
Yeah, you can use cooler names, I guess.
That too. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, all told, like I said, there was a period of my experience with Beyond the Horizon where I'm like, okay, I think I see what this is for the Feld crowd. This is for the Stefan Feld crowd. It's more Feldy, it's more Lacerdy. And there are people who want that vibe. But again, if the effects are really unbalanced, if the random inputs are all over the place, if the factions aren't balanced, is this really for that crowd? Personally, one of the things that I always appreciated about Beyond the Sun was how it had this cool conceit, and it focused mostly on that cool conceit, and it was structured, and it was focused, and there's a parsimonious number of resources to manage, and it was just a tight design. Whereas I really feel like Beyond the Horizon has taken that and said, oh, but we can add all these things, seldom asking if they should.
Yeah. Less focused, harder teach, longer play.
And Beyond the Sun's on Board Game Arena. Give it a shot if you're at all curious. And that was Beyond the Horizon. And that is going to do it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. We really appreciate your spending the time. Take care of yourselves. Take care of your hobby. Thank you, Rules Explainer. See you next time.
Peace.
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark Bickman. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
GEICO makes it easy to get affordable renter's insurance in as little as 90 seconds. And then you'll start to wonder why everything else isn't so fast. Like, why does it take so long to do the dishes? A meal that's gone in three requires 45 minutes worth of dishes. Doesn't make sense. But it does make sense to get renter's insurance through GEICO. That way, that pile of dirty dishes and the other things you love are covered. Get more with GEICO.